You're listening to Sound Poetry. I am your host, David Gilmore. This is Sound Poetry, and I'm your host, David Gilmore, on Radio Tacoma 101.9 FM. We have today a wild and woolly poet from Astoria, Oregon, Florence Sage. Aha! Now, you do write mysterious poems, too. The one that I found perhaps more mysterious than any was this House of This Morning. Okay. If we take a break from the liveliness of those other ones, we can get back there soon. The House of This Morning, most psychological state of mind here that is worth pondering.
I like to portray people, sort of catch them in a moment of confusion or self-questioning. And this one, like the others, does this. House of This Morning. She enters this house this morning as if she doesn't know the floor plan. And whether she lives here or ever did, and she should remember. Or she shouldn't, because she doesn't and never did live here, and has nothing here to remember, through no fault of her own. She enters this house with her feet barely touching the floors, as if she doesn't have feet, or the house doesn't have floors, and as if there's nothing wrong with either way for things to be in this house, or maybe anywhere, not anymore. Calmly, calmly she enters this house. The ifs, the ands, and buts, and even the whys don't matter, as she learns the floor plan to this house that presents itself to her as if that's how it works. And she's supposed to stay the night and bring groceries into the kitchen when she finds it, and have her lunch, and in the evening throw a party in some other room. What will she wear? Not this. And who will come? She sent no invitations, and find herself a bed, and wake up just as calm tomorrow somewhere else.
Yes. So there is much mystery in there, isn't there?
Yeah. Yeah.
Do you care what state of mind the listener imagines, or is it just there to have the listener say, well, could it be this, could it be that? What is your main thrust in that?
Just to sort of sneak in on their certainty. You know, I don't think I like people's certainty very much.
Yeah.
I don't trust it. In fact, I think about uncertainty a lot, because I think that modern life is tolerating uncertainty. And I think if you have a liberal cast of mind, which liberal arts and science is not liberal politically, but a liberal kind of mind, that you actually might seek uncertainty and be able to hold, and in fact, enjoy holding more than one idea in your head at once. That to me is modern life, to be able to hold more than one idea in your mind. And then, of course, it started with a dream, you can probably tell. And you better tolerate uncertainty if you're going to dream.
Right. That's certainly part of some of your other poems that I have in front of me here. Menagerie is one of those that is very dream-oriented and much wilder than normal. But perhaps this one would be a good one to follow, that Menagerie, a Lyric Manifesto.
Yeah. It's a manifesto because this is me as I think of myself as a poet, and lyric because I write basically lyric poetry, which is poetry with rhythm and repetition of sounds and things like that, that kind of, as I say, sneak in to your mind. They sneak the words in, they sneak the thoughts in.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't know. I hope this is me. This is how I think of myself. But you'll notice there are deer here, and I have recently acquired a deer who comes to here. She's a yearling, a doe, and she comes looking for something, and I put out apples every evening and a little trough of water and some oats. So I have a deer, and I call her Deary. And she and I look at each other, and sometimes she comes up like within 4 feet of me. So I have a deer. Menagerie, a lyric manifesto. And the epigraph is from Carl Sandburg, his poem, Wilderness. I keep this wolf because the wilderness gave it to me. Oh, I got a zoo. I got a menagerie inside my ribs, said Carl Sandburg. My menagerie. Tonight, I wear a loose white gown and hair blown wild by wind, and my eyes reflect the pewter sky as if blind to the world as ancient Homer's. I know the effect is temporary, as a dream, but for the time, I could unsettle even myself. The dream is asking me who I am, so still and staring. Why would it want to know when I don't? Trying in its way to define the woman standing before us among the trees, waiting for poetry. Haec femina, trying in spite of my misgivings. A family of deer leaps across my vision and stops to graze together in a clearing. Prey animals aware of the watcher. Their teardrop eyes seem unconcerned that I'll step forward, though to them, my eyes stare deeper blue than cobalt. They bend their long napes to the foliage. Comes morning and I have to leave them there. But I can't go on without them. I linger on my pillow and keep my eyes closed even as I brush my teeth. I want them back. Long legged and grazing. Can a dream explain a person? I wonder what it would say. I wonder if I can take it. Over coffee, I worry about revealing so much of myself. But I tell my dream, okay, and good luck if you really can figure it out. Go ahead and tell us. But be sure to include the deer. And other creatures I fall in love with in the night from somewhere wild and keep as long as they will stay, deeper than my sentimental heart and more compelling than imagination. They come and bay for company, snuffle and snort, yowl and hoof and bray, and they know me. And remembered faces gone away because life and death are messy and mean and they've slipped through the tears in the fabric. And the adelas, the out of step, the mildly and mightily confused and confusing, the tossers and turners in trouble with sleep, the wanderer, the ecstatic, the madly merry, the bereft, the defiant, the strong objector, the kids who collect all the detentions, us who abandon our best resolutions. The men who weep for pity in the streets and those who can't go back. Women who rejoice and have the baby anyway. The ones without who cuddle infants on the wards. Those who drag their feet, cut their arms, change sex, lose and find their perfect footing. And all the radiant geniuses, known and not, who fail at family life while making utter magic. The wilderness has given to them all. Listen for the howl. Wild, where I carry them and make poems. And that will be answer enough who this woman is. No matter in floating gown or jeans or plaid pajamas. I contain this feral, fecund place. And maybe there's a madness there. And maybe grace. Not haunted, but inhabited and waiting. where the solemn deer raise their heads and see a blue beyond our wildest dreams. There I stand. If I could just please close my eyes.
Yeah. Poets have a long history with dreams.
Yes.
I don't know if there's ever been an anthology of poetry regarding dreams, but there certainly could be.
Let's do one.
That's right. It would be an enjoyable task searching them out and putting them together. Mm-hmm. But there is so much life, as you proved there, in a dream that's you're seeking yourself as you imagine and embody some of these creatures. You're not just describing them. It's as though you're trying to become part of them, with them. Yes.
Yeah, I think so. Yeah.
And the next one, I think, will follow in that same line on the Wadzu's back.
Oh, gosh,
that,
yeah.
That one, too, is very much in the same lyrical but emotional pattern with animals galore.
Yes, my animals galore. On the Bwadzu's back, you'll tell me in the morning, as you apologize for night, though we can't help how we sleep, that this pelt is a reindeer come down with you from Lapland, well above the 66th parallel north, where the Sami call them Bwadzu and ride them like horses. And is not the wolf I thought. But how important in the early hours is the truce, confusing predator and prey for company at a time of night when things easily get confused. I found you already snoring hard in your bed and flung comfortably over most of the mattress, sleeping large and loud. Your grass-owl form settled into place. I could watch you dream the night, but can't disturb you. Anyway, I'm too awake to lie with you and sleep. And since there are no other beds in the house because you've been divesting, I come downstairs with a pillow to the den. Finding no blankets down here, I pull the wolf pelt off your armchair to cover the chilly leather couch, and then your warmest, best winter coat off a hook in the hallway as a blanket, and should I not? And then my long sweater on top. We'll be picking stiff, hollow hairs off your black coat and my loose-knit sweater in the morning. Bwadzu hairs, and I'll keep some in a pocket. Warm as wool, I lie here on the wolf's back, the Arctic gray wolf I believe in for the night, the alpha male who can hear the rhythm of my heart even on the approach so well he knows me. My belly full of dinner you bought us down the street, three courses prefixed with pairings. I'm digesting, holding a book I'm not reading, drifting thoughts and recent dreams. I'm prowling through the dark and swearing the decaf after dinner wasn't decaf enough. Or is it the wolf? The latest dream was yesterday's, where my father returns from his death to my joy, so young to remark on the cobalt toils. The latest dream was yesterday's, where my father returns from his death to my joy, so young to remark on the cobalt tiles that don't exist in my bathroom, covering the walls. Quite a blue room, he says with his little smile. But in the passageway, the bird in a cage I've forgotten again to feed for weeks, still flitting and feathered bright blue, but almost slim as a Sharpie pen, his eyes accusing I've neglected him for writing and the dog, human complications and muddled thoughts. Or is that my own I reflected, and I'm sorry? Better take care of that, says Dad. Comes a man I know or don't tonight with eyes of brighter blue than my father's and mine, so like a reindeer's in the snow, and smiles at me like he knows who I am, and who I am makes him smile, yes, like that. And he laughs at how obvious he is, and that's a laugh I like, as I look around for seeds and water and cups for the bird and consider whose winter eyes. And when they've disappeared, man, dad, and bird, I wonder, awake on the back of the yellow-eyed wolf, why am I not sleeping with the man of my dreams in a bed? Or is that you upstairs under the quilt? Sammy eyes flicker across the tundra. Instead of lying here not sleeping with the watchful wolf, who in the morning will become the gentler, stronger caribou, and after breakfast of toast, moss, and mushrooms and herbal tea, now that I found the cups, the boatsu I have clung to through the night will take me up on his long boreal migration to dream under the green northern lights.
What a ride, what a dream, what a dream world. Now you bring your father into this one. In the one where you describe your father gone fishing.
Oh, yes.
Why? Since you have introduced him in this one here, so your father who comes up with blue tiles, cobalt tiles, you've got that in. Did you have that in your house at times? Was that?
No. Never. Mm-hmm. No. No. Mm-hmm. It's just that my father's eyes were a lovely blue. And I found out that, caribou have blue eyes in the snow, you know, in the snow. And deer see blue, see brighter, like dozens of times brighter than we do, because of they focus on that side of the spectrum and the UV spectrum, and that orange and red are things they can't see, which helps hunters. But the worst thing a hunter can wear is green or blue, because the deer won't really see them. But I kind of like that because I always liked my father's blue eyes, you know.
Mm-hmm. So, you know. Well, you bring him to life in this one, Gone Fishing.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And this does not have any anxiety in it. No. We're going to have a break here.
Yes, that's right. This is a portrait of sorts.
Yeah, this is more, from the memoir that I wrote of my dad and mom and, you know, us kids a little bit, you know. I tried to be really careful about getting who he really was and not or exaggerate. Okay, this one has a very trite title of Gone Fishing. Give Dad a rowboat on Rice Lake soon after dawn, with his fiddly two-horse motor in back. The family asleep in cottages on the shore, sunfish for breakfast. Give him the River Grande, feeding a Dunville weir. The rapids under the Jordan Harbor Bridge. Lazy Grinder Creek out near the cemetery grounds. A fast stream through the Muzzerkevich farm while the kids jump in the hayloft after country lunch, swing out from a rope. Sometimes instead, a quieter brother or sister-in-law companion who could come, he'd take any Okolowski girl or husband to the splashing water at the foot of Dunville Dam. Give him rock bass, perch, pike, throw the carp and catfish back. Give him a fishing pole and lots of line, a sinker, a spinner, silver hooks, minnows from the laundry tub and a can of morning worms from the lawn. Give him a summer evening when the mosquitoes and other suckers and nibbers come out and the fish are biting. An afternoon in fall, a halfway sheeted bank and dry boots. Let leaves flutter around his feet, the kids and dog nearby. let his son turn brown as he scouts for the flattest stones or throws in a line. Let the girls loll with Betty and Veronica, and in between stories, look up at the busy green world and swat at bugs and gaze at moving water until hypnotized and plop in stones and create the best round ripples and try not to be loud and scare off the fish. Let his wife be at home with a slow day and the radio. Have sandwiches packed for all and a big thermos of milky black tea. Then footlongs with the works going home to give mum a break from supper. And maybe stop for lake fish and chips wrapped in old news with vinegar, salt, and grease. Give him these. You'd be giving Dad his whistling songs, his Verdi, his Chuck Berry, his Fats Domino, his green door to his own blue heaven, and his kind of God.
So this was in Canada.
Yes. Hamilton, Ontario. Mm-hmm.
Yes, Hamilton, Ontario. I've been there a few times.
I heard.
Yeah, it's. I was there in snowy springtime too. It didn't always become spring with the season of the month, but
you can't
really winter used to lurk there. But a wonderful town, industrial all around that area, right?
Steel mills, yeah.
Yeah. Did your dad work at one of the industrial works?
Or complicated answer. He did for a time, but he lost his job around the time of a big strike. And the stories differ as to why he lost his job. But I wrote about that in my book about the man who whistled. Yeah, stories vary. But yes, he did. And then eventually, he went and, you know, became an immigrant hustler. You know, you have to figure out what you're going to do. So he sold real estate and insurance and, you know.
Oh, wow.
And then bought our properties up and fixed them up and rented them and sold them, you know. It all worked out. Then in his 50s, he went back for retraining on new machines because he'd been a machinist and got a job back at the Steel Company of Canada, Stelco, they called it. Mm. Yeah. But there were three mills at the time in Hamilton when I was young. It was the Steel City of Canada, like Pittsburgh would have been to America. Hamilton was.
Sure. That's the way it struck me, too. I was from a steel town, even in England, myself. So I knew that feeling of, and of course I knew my aunt and uncle there who had been British at one time and moved to Canada.
Yeah.
But the feeling is that you have someone who really knew how to have a recreational life.
Yes.
Knew how to spend a day, and no worries, just. Making it through the day with whistling as he went.
Yeah. That's right.
Yeah. And so as we, let's say we conclude this segment here, we'll go to something that again goes back to film and it incorporates again the sensual imagery, the white underwear. in three parts, which I think is a very lively one that we can find a really sound conclusion.
Okay.
All right.
These are in my 2014 book called Nevertheless. Yes. Uh-huh. White underwear. One. Brando. He was young and brooding. And yelling, Stella, our secret name. In black and gray and white up on the silver screen, like nothing before in film, he caught our breath. His sleeveless undershirt, a rough foil for the muscles of a laboring man. Wasn't a woman in the dark, watching in the dark, whose fingers didn't want those arms. Men working up a sweat stripped to their tanks, browning hot in summer, and women always look. wet on all that skin that shows, basketball, tennis, hefting shingles and boards, chopping autumn wood, doing things with their bodies men do to feel whole. Outlined in winter, you can trace it, if he'll let you, through dress shirts or denim blues, that cozy little lair his mom taught him to wear, and we tell our sons. It keeps his torso so good and warm, nicely protected. You take off your shirt when we're alone to reveal, across the vital expanse of your chest, my favorite men's garment covering you in ribbed white cotton I take in my hands to touch the complex passion of a woman who notices a man in a white undershirt. Part two. When we were new, and love was a long commute, in a morning dream, I saw myself wake to find your white underpants neatly folded the way you do on the dresser in our hotel room after you went off early to work and let me sleep. I worried how to get them to you at your job, as you'd be needing them, wouldn't you? Searching, upset. Shall I call your boss to tell you I have them? You know, dreams. Well, when I did wake up, that's where they were. How had I known? Other rooms in the dawn. You left them on the floor, once at my house in the bed. Leaving no other tangible trace back then, you left your underpants in my care. Each time I washed them and held them warm close to my face to find where you were, and handed them back next time without a word to let you leave them for me again. And the last part. Hold on a second, I have to hang up my pants. Simple little words you say. I follow after them as you set down your phone. When you come back to the call, I'll just be pretending I'm still here at home. I'm hovering in some diffused dimension in your hotel room as you fold your wool trousers over a hanger. Place them still neatly pressed in the closet, ready to wear tomorrow for work. A sequence I've watched many times, suspended in a space just about to land on the spread before you come to lie with me on the bed for mouthing and roughing and rumpling up your pure white underwear that you leave on for me to peel away, laundry sweet against your long summer body that mine adheres to wholly in the complete innocence of our two lovers' hearts.
Excellent. You have really made a lot of white underwear images and actions, and no dreams perhaps there, but you do say,
oh, yeah, there was.
You know, dreams. You know, dreams. You should call your boss. You know, dreams.
Yeah, that one. Like, I must have been dreaming that I saw them. Should I call your boss? No. Yeah.
Well, thank you so much, Florence. Florence Sage, poet of the sensual and the lively dream imagery that perhaps will haunt you and or motivate you to inspect and maybe investigate your own dreams for poetry.
Yeah.
I'm sure that the listeners have had a lovely time, a lively time, and actually a stimulating time with your works. And we're so glad to have found you, to have you on. Thank you so much, Florence.
Thank you for inviting me, and I've had a good time too. Thank you. Bye.
You've been listening to Sound Poetry. I was your host with Florence Sage. I'm David Gilmore.